Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome, Oisey. What's up? Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome. Welcome back to everybody else. Welcome to anybody joining us on the Zoom for the first time. I like to start this weekly meditation group by asking you to talk to each other for a few minutes before we meditate and I give a talk of some sort. Because Buddhism, what we teach here is Buddhism. And one of the core tenets of Buddhism is making connections with other people that are practicing. It's called, there's three core tenets, three refuges, taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. The Sangha is community. And the whole system of Buddhism is designed to be done relationally in community with people, not by yourself in a cave, but gathering together in how we behave and how we speak and how we have conflict and all of it. It's all relational, all of Buddhism, which is sometimes surprising to people. They think like, oh, I thought it was just about getting enlightened on my own. But all of it is about enlightened behavior and learning how to do that within relationship with other people. So I don't know, a handful of new people tonight. I don't know if anybody's brand new to Buddhism. What I wanted to ask you to speak about in the short breakout groups was about what kind of changes you're noticing so far in your meditation practice or your study and practice of Buddhism. What kind of positive changes has mindfulness brought to you, or compassion, or forgiveness, or practicing the five principles, the five precepts of renunciation. We call it the Dharma, Buddhism, we call it. And there's, we can break it down into an ethical way of life and a meditative effort that leads to wisdom in our speech and our actions and on our livelihood and in our relationships. So what kind of progress have you seen so far? I'm asking you to do this really in brief with each other because yesterday I celebrated 36 years of my recovery from addiction and my Buddhist practice and my recovery from addiction started at the same time. So instead of giving a lecture tonight, I'm going to reflect on some of the changes that I've noticed over these last 36 years and reflect a little bit on that, how that process has unfolded in a very personal way for me. So I'd like you to share with each other in brief some of the changes that you're noticing. How's it helping? How's it decreasing the suffering? How's it increasing kindness or generosity or the untanglement, the disentanglement of the addiction to the mind or the identification with the ego and the self? So something in brief. You only get like, we do this for 5 minutes. So there's three people, you each get like a minute and a half. So be aware of that. It's also a conscious practice of talking to each other and not going over your minute and a half and also not avoiding it, but actually showing up and saying, this is the first meditation practice. It's speaking to each other and it's listening to each other. And if you're here in the room, you're sort of like peer pressured into it. At home, about a third of you choose to avoid this part of our spiritual practice by not joining the breakout group. I want to shame you into joining the group, knowing that it is part of the practice to join that, to meet some people, to connect, to build this refuge in the Sangha and to practice doing it even if it's uncomfortable for you. That's so much of what we're learning, to do shit that we don't necessarily want to do and to stop doing some of the shit that we do want to do. That's part of it. So go ahead and find two or three people in the room that you don't know. Best to do it with people you don't know so you meet some people. And some of the changes you're noticing. finding a posture for meditation that is upright but relaxed, allowing your eyes to be closed and making any adjustments, eventually settling into relative stillness in a posture that you can maintain. Even if you become uncomfortable, it's okay to sit still through discomfort without fidgeting or moving away from it. The primary technique in this tradition is mindfulness, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness. So that even if our bodies become uncomfortable, we just try to meet it with a friendly acceptance rather than avoidance or trying to get rid of the discomfort. We use that sensation, all of the sensations, all of the emotions, all of the mind states are included ultimately in the mindfulness meditation technique. Present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness. It's useful to soften, to release any unnecessary tension in the face, shoulders, chest, belly. And although ultimately mindfulness is inclusive of the thinking mind and the emotions, all of the sense doors and all of the sensations, it's useful to spend the first few minutes gathering our attention, choosing an object of awareness to focus on. Most common is to use the breath, the sensations that the breath creates, mindfulness of breathing, allowing everything else to be in the background. Bringing our full attention to the nostrils or chest or belly, wherever you feel the breath, most easily, most accessible. The Buddha's straightforward and simple meditation instruction was something like breathing in, know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, know that you're breathing out. The temperature, the texture, the depth. Give full attention, knowing, receiving awareness to the breath. And the attention is drawn back into thinking as it naturally will be. This is where the non-judgmental aspect of the practice comes in. Don't judge. Accept, acknowledge. but disengage from the mind that wants to plan, remember, worry, hope. Not trying to stop the mind from thinking, but for now we're trying to stop being involved, stop engaging. Stop paying attention to your thoughts. Give your full attention to the body sitting, breathing. Let the thoughts be in the background. first foundation of mindfulness, awareness of the body, the breath, helps us break our addiction to our identification with the thinking mind. It's an important skill to learn to ignore your mind, to disengage, to not obey it, to not be so involved in the thoughts and emotions that the brain produces, to have more choice over how you relate to your thoughts, your emotions. Buddha's instruction started with this encouragement to ignore the mind, pay attention to the breath. But then he expanded. He said, once you've established this mindfulness of breathing, now include your whole body. Know that you're sitting, know the posture, the contact, sensations created by sitting in the chair, the cushion. Investigate the feeling tone, the second foundation of mindfulness. What are you experiencing as pleasant in the body? Or unpleasant, uncomfortable? Or neutral? What sensations, how much of the body can you feel, but it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant? We investigate, we explore. Inquiry into what's happening right now, moment to moment. And then we open to including the thoughts and emotions that arise in the mind, the heart, to include the sense doors, the sounds, smells, tastes. Even with the eyes closed, still can bring awareness to seeing, eye consciousness, shape, color, light. And bringing awareness to the mind, try to allow thoughts to arise and pass like bubbles, a plan bubble passing through awareness, knowing, oh, that's something I'm planning or I'm hoping for or I'm worrying about. The mind is planning. Or a memory. Investigating the impermanent nature of thought, how thought is constantly changing, just like the breath is coming and going. Sounds are appearing, sustaining and dissolving. Same thing with our thoughts, our emotions, the fears, the cravings or desires in the mind, the heart, the body. Arising and passing. the feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral applies to all of the experience, to thoughts, to sounds, sensations, everything that we experience, we perceive by we like it or we don't like it. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or perhaps neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Mindfulness brings awareness to what's happening and how it feels moment to moment. And we learn to meet our experience in a wiser way. Meeting our pain, both the subtle unpleasantnesses, as well as the big pains, we learn to tolerate, to accept. And ultimately to meet our own pain in the heart, in the mind, the body, with compassion, tending, caring, accepting the unpleasant nature of some of our experiences. more we pay attention in this way, the more we understand the impermanent nature of all things, all conditioned phenomena, emotions, thoughts, sensations, the impermanence teaches us to let go. No matter how pleasant the feeling tone may be, when we cling to it, we create suffering. We create stress. We incline our heart towards non-attached appreciation, untangling. Allowing nature to be as it is, impermanent, arising, passing, sensations and emotions. No trying to control or manipulate, but accepting reality just as it is. With kind awareness. The last couple of minutes of the sitting, let go of the mindfulness technique and turn towards a simple forgiveness practice where you say to yourself, this mind, this body, all of the memories and things that we are identified with, our personality, our hopes and dreams. Say to yourself, using your own first name, silently in your heart, I forgive you and I love you. To this body, this mind, I forgive you and I love you. Forgiving the mind for all of the self-centered fear it produces. The craving, the aversion, the clinging. I forgive you. and I love you. Loving awareness, loving intention. Towards yourself, even if you don't quite mean it yet. I forgive you. And I love you over and over. Before I begin my reflections on my practice and experience and this anniversary that I'm celebrating, any questions about the meditation instructions or this practice? Does it make sense? Is there any clarifications or questions about how to work with some of the experience that you're having in meditation? Spend a few minutes with that if there is anything at home. If you have a question in the reactions tab, you can raise your hand on the Zoom screen, please.
I continue to have a problem with this whole concept of detach and accept things the way they are. And I'm like, I don't know what that doesn't sit well with me, since like even ACT, acceptance coding therapy, is a big one. I'm just like, isn't the point of human experience to have secure attachment, not insecure attachment to things? And that's part of the pain of life. That's the beauty of it. And it's like, I don't know. There's also, like, for me as a Latino, a white centricity of that, like, detach yourself. And it's just like, I don't know. It doesn't sit with me. Like, something about it, I don't know what it is. And I'm still exploring that with my therapist, why it bugs me.
Yeah. I'll repeat it briefly and then I'll have some discussion about that. People at home probably couldn't hear all of what the question kind of comment was struggling. It's not sitting well, the encouragement towards non-attachment. And so I'll ask you a couple questions and for everyone to reflect on. In your direct experience, what's the difference between connection and clinging? What's it feel like when you're connected to yourself or connected to someone else? And there's we'd say even a healthy connection. And what's the difference between that when there's like clinging or craving or attachment?
You're stuck in your trauma and attachment. And in the other one, you're actually empathizing and living the present moment with the person.
So non-attachment is that.
So the empathy and the presence is there.
Present, connected, loving, tolerant, all of the things. Many of you have seen me do this lots of times, but so non-attachment is this, is connection, is, you know, and so, the, you know, whatever side is, this can be to each other in relationships, but also just to ourselves, to our own experience, connected awareness, but no clinging, but there's a touching, there's a proximity, there's a empathy, there's a, all of those things, awareness, and then attachment is clinging. And the problem with clinging is the impermanence and the change. And it's like, I'm trying to control you and not let you change, whether you is your mind or your emotions or someone else, that clinging, which is like, doesn't make room for the organic unfolding of experience. It's manipulating, it's controlling, it's, and then detachment is, and you know, and you, I think you heard it, and many people hear non-attachment as detachment, which is this sort of overcorrection from clinging to separateness from. Where what I'm encouraging, and I also heard the thing about the sort of critique of, you know, it, certainly in America, it has become a sort of buzzword, mindfulness and acceptance, commitment therapy, and, you know, this sort of, you know, watered down form of mindfulness. And I heard that you said it feels sort of white and, you know, it's been sort of popularized by.
It's LA, it makes money.
Yeah, sure. It's been monetized and it's been, you know, the apps and all of that. But also remember, like, this is coming from a brown person in India 2,600 years ago. This isn't modern pop psychology. This is ancient Indian spiritual path that, you know, Western pop psychology has borrowed some of the mindfulness techniques from, but the non-attached teachings come from this path to enlightenment from, you know, a person of color thousands of years ago. So it's not just sort of, you know, the white ladies doing yoga and telling you to let go, or the white guys or whatever, you know, it's not just that.
Thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense
to
that.
Yeah.
Tibby,
sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think, you probably have, but I don't think I've ever heard you use that word connection before versus belief. And it really helped me in my understanding of it. It's like clinging is hoping for something that isn't there. It's not there. And the connection, like when you were talking about it, and I was like, oh, that's why when I have the connection, I'm totally at peace. And when I'm clinging, it's, I guess it's so obvious, it should be so obvious, but even when that person thing or whatever, I'm eating the ice cream, right? And I'm clinging to it because it's really not the connection. That really helpful using that word.
I'm glad. My teacher, actually, I am conditioned to say non-attachment, and it works for me. But one of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, who I'll talk a little bit about tonight, actually uses the term unentangled. And that feels different too, right? Like, think about when you're entangled and, you know, snarled and in a you know, kind of knotted up in something or someone or some emotion, or being unentangled. Not like this, right? This is a tangle, but unentangled, still connected to, still present with, but not entangled with. Please, Cakes.
Hi. I have a little bit of a more physical question about meditation. Sometimes I do struggle with sitting still often, so that's one thing. And then, but more so when I'm in pain, which sometimes I'm just in like chronic pain. And so sitting is really painful, and then I'll find like a 2-minute pose where it's not chronic pain, and then it'll come. I really beat myself up to not move, because I just want to know, am I translating what you're saying incorrectly? When I'm like, no, just sit, it hurts so bad, like just able to not adjust for like 30 minutes in pain.
Yes. I'll repeat it briefly for the people at home. Question about when in discomfort, whether to move or not move, and the kind of, and I think I am guilty of saying things like, you know, it's okay to be uncomfortable and to maintain your posture, and that's true for most, you know, like anytime you're giving instructions to however many people are gathered tonight, lots of people, though there's not one instruction that's going to be right for every single person. So you give a sort of general instruction. And in general, it's really useful to learn to sit still, even if you're uncomfortable. In general, that is, you know, it's part of the learning to tolerate and then develop compassion for pain. And so we want to break our habitual reactive tendency to discomfort, which is fidgeting and moving away from it all of the time. In general, that's true. If you have chronic pain, if it's too much. So each one of you want to find your own way, and specifically for you, find your edge of it. And like you said, 2 minutes, or maybe you increase that to 5 minutes. And then after 5 minutes, you're like, you know, it's really a lot. And if I just move my leg a little, even actually, as you were asking that, my knee was hurting. And I was like, you know, I think I'm going to straighten my leg out. And I've been like that for an hour now, and it's starting to hurt. There's nothing wrong with moving at times. It is okay at times to move. I think I do tend towards, it's also really okay to be in pain, and you're not going to injure yourself in 30 minutes. And you're going to probably increase your tolerance, but also you don't want to turn meditation into something that you don't want to do because you think you have to be in pain the whole time. So if you need to shift sometimes, shift sometimes. But also it's okay to sit here and be uncomfortable for 30 minutes and to see, oh, I can do that. I don't usually give myself permission. My mind usually kicks me out of everything that's uncomfortable. And then we see it not only on the cushion, we see how we do play that out in our lives. Oh, I'm not very good at staying in uncomfortable, you know, conflicts or situations or social anxiety or whatever it is. And the more we learn to sit still, the more we increase that, oh, I can actually walk through unpleasant experiences in my life with presence, with non-attached, connected, compassionate intention. And the meditation teaches us that. When I'm going to talk about myself a bunch tonight. And when I started meditating, I couldn't sit still very well. And I wanted to fidget all of the time. And then over the months and years, I started to see like, oh, I can sit here and be uncomfortable. And it's okay. And I don't have to do anything about it. I think so. Okay. I mean, you've been at it for how long? A couple of years?
No.
1 year?
Maybe 7 months.
Only 7 months, yeah. Have you seen some progress from the 2 minutes to the...
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it's okay. It is okay to move around a little bit. Yeah, please.
Just, I wanted to briefly touch on that. I also got to think about shoulder and neck pain. Today I didn't, thankfully, because I found a posture that worked for me, but typically I got through the day to wake up on a Thursday when I'm here. It hurts, and I find that if it's distracting the meditation or it's becoming so uncomfortable that it's hard to be mindful, for me it's okay, but I'll just adjust a little bit, and then the more I've meditated, just it's easier to bring myself back. And then if I find myself getting too uncomfortable again, I'll adjust a bit. Be mindful, be compassionate towards that, and then fall back into the mindfulness. And I think slowly, if it's kind of you're saying, you can develop more tolerance. But yeah, I mean, I think it's important to like balance the two.
We're pretty relaxed. I'm pretty relaxed as a teacher around here. You know, there's certain traditions, like in some of the Zen traditions, where the whole emphasis is on posture and stillness. And in some traditional Japanese Zen, they will actually come around with a stick and kind of give you a smack, not like an abusive smack, but like an awareness smack, like, you know, pay attention, you're slouching or you're fidgeting and sit still. And, you know, like you think of the Zen stick as some sort of like weird punishment, but it's not. It's a sort of like, pay, you know, you're slouching, pay attention and maintain your posture. Here it's late. And with mindfulness, everything, you know, even that the pain is a distraction, There's no such thing as a distraction in mindfulness, ultimately, because present time awareness of what's happening. What's happening is pain. Am I distracted? What am I distracted from? That's what's happening. Present time awareness of pain becomes our meditation. Now, if we're, you know, and then they're checking in with that and being like, oh, I just want to be comfortable. I just want to, you know, it's a distraction from my comfort, but we're not in this for comfort. We're in this for freedom from suffering. And changing our relationship to pain is a core aspect of what's going to lead to freedom from suffering, and seeing that difference between unpleasantness and then the added resistance to the unpleasantness that creates the suffering. And so ultimately what Buddhism is teaching us is learn to meet your pain with compassion, learn to meet pleasure with non-entanglement, non-clinging, and also learn to, you know, not be so identified with the mind as who you are, kind of waking up to that truth that the mind has a mind of its own and you don't have to obey it all of the time. Some discernment gets developed. Sure.
I was meditating and I'm like, the next season, House of the Dragon. Grad school tomorrow. Oh, work.
Yeah.
Interviews. It's just that split attention.
Make room for all of it.
I'm moving too.
In mindfulness, there's room for all of it. However fast the mind is going, there's nowhere in this technique that I'm teaching that it's about having a quiet mind or a slow mind, or it's about just knowing what's happening. Oh, lots of racing thoughts, lots of rumination, lots of whatever's going on. That's what's going on. Awareness is bigger than the contents of your attention deficit, because it's not about focused attention. Well, this isn't a concentration practice. It's a mindfulness. It's inclusive. Make room for it. Like there's bubbles. I use that image of bubbles. Lots of bubbles. It's a fucking bubble party. It's what are those like foam parties, like the bars, and you go in, there's like foam. Was that a bubble party? Foam party. Yeah. Sometimes your mind's like that. Like, oh man, my mind's full of foam, bubbles everywhere. Okay, full of foam. Judy, last one.
So I'd like to share with the two of you. So one of the things that you taught me, which has really helped. Now I'm not in chronic pain, but I do have discomfort sometimes. Is just that when the time comes that I could just watch that pain, and just like you told us, is there's always a beginning and there's always an end. So watching and feeling that pain, and then eventually it just kind of goes away. I think that was very helpful for me, that it comes and then just watch it and then watch it go.
Yeah.
And then in regards to the ADHD, I was having that problem today where no matter, thank God you kept on saying, go back to, you know, like how you're sitting or, and the breath and things like that. But I was struggling with my ADD, was that these voices really were coming loud in front of me all the time. And I kept on having to remind myself to go back to the breath. And it just wanted to just keep on being in front of me and having the whole discussion of the day or whatever that was. Today was a little challenging in regards to the ADD.
I come back to make room for it, include it, include the pain, include the thoughts, let go of the idea that there's a good meditation where your mind is quiet. That'll happen sometimes, but is it even that useful? It's actually probably more useful to be uncomfortable and develop compassion for it, and to have a loud mind and to break your identification and addiction to it. It's probably more useful. Sometimes if you just sit down and it's like all pleasant and peaceful, what's that? What's the, you know, utility in that? How's that helping you free yourself from suffering? It's just like, oh yeah, it was really comfortable. It was great. Not that useful. Really painful? Useful. You're going to increase your compassion. Really loud mind, and you could investigate it and see, you know, break your some identification with it. Oh, my mind was thinking. Oh, I told my mind to shut the fuck up. It kept thinking. Oh, I must not be as in much control of my mind as I thought I was. It's not so personal, not so much. It's really useful to see. That's liberating. So I think I probably do this most years on my birthday, my sober anniversary. Reflect a little bit, and I don't know, but I'd like to reflect a little bit on this last year and on the 36 years, you know, the setup. Probably most people are somewhat familiar with my story, but not everybody. I was a teenage drug addict. Even before I found drugs, I think this is somewhat pertinent. I was suicidal as a child. I grew up in a kind of situation where I was taught about reincarnation. My father was a Buddhist, Hindu, New Age, you know, hippie. And so I was introduced to Indian thought from birth. And I was taught about death. And my dad did a lot of work in death and dying. And so I was aware of death from a young age. And I was taught that death isn't the end and that there's a reincarnation process that happens. So I took my pain as a child, parents' divorce, some abusive stuff going on. And I decided I didn't want to exist. And I had a suicidal thought of ending life because I could start over. So my desire, it wasn't kind of like get it, you know, end it forever. It was just like, you could trade in this incarnation for possibly a better one, was my thought at 5 years old. And I had a knife and an idea of like, maybe I'll just, this is unpleasant. I don't know how to be uncomfortable. This is painful. I don't want to exist in this. And what happened for me was I realized that if I drank some of my mom's wine and smoked some of my dad's weed, and that it really took the edge off of that angst and that discomfort at 6 years old and 7 years old and 10 years old eating their LSD and their mushrooms. And, you know, by the time I'm a teenager, I'm strung out and I'm smoking crack and shooting heroin and drinking alcoholically. And at 17 years old in 1988, I'm sitting in juvenile hall. And, you know, and I grew up, both of my parents were meditators on some level. But I thought meditation was just like for hippies. And I didn't think that there was anything useful. I probably thought I had some delusion of like, oh yeah, you just like sitting around and you're fucking lazy. You don't care about the revolution, anarchy we need to create. Whatever ideas I had about it, I just felt like it didn't apply to me as a practical thing in any way. And luckily my parents didn't push it on me. They modeled it, they were into it. But they weren't like, you have to do this and you have to be Buddhist and you have to any of that. They, you know, it's what they were into. But when I was willing, my father used the appropriate kind of timing for an intervention while I was, you know, looking at my third felony and sitting in jail. And my dad said, you want to, I'll give you some meditation instructions. And I was desperate enough and enough pain and enough willingness at that moment to say like, I'll try anything because I know I'm a drug addict. I've been strung out now for some years. I keep getting locked up over and over. And that suicidal ideation came back. I had a sort of pseudo suicide attempt while I was in juvie. And I started meditating and I was, you know, my dad gave me simple instructions like we did tonight. Pay attention to your breath and try to ignore your mind. Breathing in, feel the breath. Breathing out, feel the breath. Each time your attention goes back into thinking, bring your attention back to the breath. Simple mindfulness of breath instructions. And I sat in my cell and tried to do it and was like, I can't really do this. My mind's all over the place and I'm, you know, detoxing and I'm afraid of, you know, my mind's going to fear of what's going to happen at court and regret for the past and shame and all of that painful mind states. But I got it on some level right away, like, oh, this is interesting. I can bring my attention out of those thoughts to my breath for like half a breath. Then I get back into them, but I didn't really realize until then that I had any choice over that I was actually possible to disengage even for just half a breath from what my mind was doing, that I could move it back to the breath, move, and then go back into thinking, back to the breath, back into thinking. And so I sat in juvie at 17 years old in 1988, trying to meditate. And had some level of a realization of like, this is useful. It's really hard. I'm not good at it, but there's hope. I felt like my early meditation experience gave me some hope that it would be possible to change my relationship to all of the suffering that my mind creates. Couldn't do it very well, but it seemed hopeful. My first couple of years of meditation, I was locked up for a few months and I was put into a group home. And then right around after I turned 18, I was let out of the group home. And I would meditate sometimes in the group home. I was really embarrassed about meditating. It was so not cool. It was so like, I don't know. There was no cultural, in my kind of punk rock, drug addict, pseudo tough guy mentality, there was nothing cool or acceptable about being a meditator. But I think, you know, a big part of my story too is that, I got into recovery through 12 steps. And the 12 step people were saying prayer and they were talking about God and, you know, this kind of very open-minded theism of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. And, but that made no sense to me. This sort of idea that there was a God that was going to remove my alcoholism and my drug addiction from me. And that there was this sort of grace and this sort of like, just let go and turn it over to this magical being. Just, I couldn't grasp that at all. But with meditation, there was like, oh, this is something not petitioning the Easter Bunny, but actually just sitting there and ignoring your mind. Not sort of, you know, kind of some, to me, which felt like a make-believe religious belief system, but a practical kind of psychological intervention of come back to the present, come back to the present, come back to the present. And the verified relief that I got when I did it. When I prayed, I felt very little relief. But when I did mindfulness practice, I felt also very little relief. A little relief. Very little, but a little, right? It wasn't like all of a sudden everything's great, but I felt like, oh no, this is practical thing that I can do. I could see the usefulness, the utility in it. At about 2 years in, you know, one of the ways that that I think about my experience here is when the Buddha first taught the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching. He said, I've discovered this pathway that leads, this middle path. He called it the middle path that leads between these two dead ends. He said, and the one dead end is looking for liberation or happiness in the world, in the material world. He said, the materialism is a dead end. You can never purchase your way to happiness. You can get all of the stuff and it won't work for the kind of freedom that we actually want to have. And then the other dead end is kind of taking religion too far into blind faith or to like extreme renunciation, asceticism path that he had done. It's like also religion can be a dead end too. He said, but this practical psychology of training your mind and understanding the impermanent nature of things and developing compassion and, you know, this Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, mindfulness as an intervention, leads between the material dead end and the religious dead end. At a couple of years in, I felt like those first couple of years when I got out of the group home and I was sober and I fucking stayed sober. And I was meditating once in a while, kind of half-assed meditation practice. And I was going to meetings and I even did the prayers and did the, you know, third step prayer. And I did that, but I didn't believe it, but I did the 12 step process. But I definitely felt like there has to be a material solution to my happiness. I really believed that, like, if I got the right motorcycle, the right relationship, the right stuff, I had, you know, teenage material, you know, I didn't need a fucking Ferrari. I just needed a Triumph. I didn't need a house. I just needed some new Doc Martens. It was, you know, it was like really low level materialism that I was in at the time. But I believed that there was a material solution. And I didn't know how to tell the truth yet. So, and I was a thief. My dishonesty was, and since I was a kid, I was a shoplifter and a, you know, burglar, and I was a thief. I was a liar, a thief, and a cheat. All of those were just, and they were, and I thought it was totally okay and justified to just, you know, take what you can get, whatever you can get away with, which is why I was in juvenile hall a lot as a kid. Drugs and stealing. But at about 2 years in, I went to my first meditation retreat, a 3-day silent meditation. I asked my dad, said, I want to get a little bit more serious about this, because I got myself into trouble. I got in trouble for graffiti. I had a house full of stolen merchandise. I was, you know, sober, but I was not honest yet. And I was half-assed meditating in my closet, and the cops were looking for me, and I was in a small town, and I was such a, my ego kind of, I got into straight edge, and I'm so grateful for straight edge. Straight edge is the punk rock movement that is drug free. And because I was already identified as a punk rock kid, and then I was like, oh, there's these drug free punk rock kids, and I need to be drug free because I'm in recovery now. And so, but then I proceeded to do straight edge graffiti all over this small surf town. And embarrassing but true, my tag was Noah Core, because I was so hardcore. So I spray painted my own name all over this town. And then the cops were like, well, there's like 4 Noahs in Santa Cruz. Which one was it? Oh, the one straight edge guy that's going Noah Core, straight edge in your face, you know, graffiti shit I was doing. Ego trip that kept me sober, grateful for it, but also kind of hit this emotional kind of bottom around, like, well, you know, this materialism, and I've got the motorcycle, I'm in the relationship, I've got the lowrider car, I got the stuff that I thought would make me happy, and it didn't work. And the only place I'm finding any real relief is in meditation, in those momentary experiences of present time awareness. This is, feels like the only thing that's actually giving me some relief. And so I, you know, my dad, who was a meditation teacher, said, well, go to this retreat. And so I went to a 3-day silent meditation retreat. This is probably 1990, maybe 91. And I remember it was so difficult to just survive 72 hours in noble silence with like 200 hippies. And I'm just like a still angry punk rock, like, what the fuck has my life come to? Like, being in jail was cool in my mentality, right? In my conditioning and my mentality. But being a meditator was not cool. But I found hope there. I found this, like, this is really hard. I'm not very good at it, but I feel like I might be able to free myself from some of this. I don't want to suffer. And I'm in so much suffering and so much confusion. And I kind of woke up pretty, you know, great. I feel like I woke up in some way to, like, there's not a material solution. The stuff didn't work. Just not taking drugs didn't work. Just being sober wasn't enough. Getting some of the stuff that I wanted wasn't enough. I was still internally miserable, afraid and angry. And so I committed more deeply to meditation. And like a, you know, that sort of, I'm grateful for this. I know not everybody has this, but a lot of us do in this Sangha, of that addictive personality type and compulsive tendency. And so I went from, you know, kind of anti-spirituality to like, this is my only hope. I'm going to be spiritual. And I'm going to go to all the meditation groups and all the meditation retreats. And also, you know, thankfully, within my subculture of the punk rock and the straight edge scene, some of those guys were also going like Hindu, like Youth of Today became Shelter, this Hindu punk band. And that was helpful for me because also something to identify with of youth culture that was being spiritual. And all of a sudden I'm vegan, straight edge, you know, chanting Hare Krishna, doing Buddhist meditation practice, all in for enlightenment. And my ego took hold of it. You know, I'm the guy that spray paints my own name on the wall, wonders why I get busted for it. So also I felt like there was some kind of youthful competitive thing of like, I'm going to get enlightened first. I'm going to go all in. I'm going to meditate every day. And I'm going to be in a, like, at like 22. I took a vow of celibacy that lasted for over 2 years. And I'm this like fake punk rock monk. Like I'm celibate, caffeine free, sugar free, nicotine free, you know, just like, and just so inflated. Just so like, I'll meditate your face off. I'll wear all white. In a sort of delusion, early youthful, spiritual, but useful, you know, looking back of like, I was very ungrounded and delusional about things, but motivated of just like, I'll meditate every day. I'm going to go to all the retreats. I'm going to, started, you know, planning my pilgrimage. And there was a real dilemma for me around like, maybe I should be a monk because those are the real ones. Those are the real Buddhists. And because I was exploring celibacy anyways, and really trying to see, you know, where is the refuge that's not sensual, that's not material, that's a spiritual refuge. And I was pretty imbalanced, I feel like, that whole first decade. But that imbalance was, I was a little uptight about my meditation practice, but I was very motivated. And I did a three, you know, I went from doing the 3 day to doing a 5 day to doing one or two or three 10-day retreats every year to doing some 1 month retreats to doing a 3 month, 90-day silent retreat about 10, 12 years into the practice. I was just like going and going and going and doing all of the retreats and the longer ones. And I feel like there's that in recovery, there's that like analogy. I was for drugs, like, and I started taking drugs when I was kind of a little kid, but I was interested in like, what's the harder drugs? Like I was very, you know, curious about heroin from a very young age. Like, you know, if pot's good, what's this heroin stuff? And crack, I loved crack. I started smoking crack when I was like 13, 14 years old, free basin. And I was just like, this is the best. You can't get any higher than this. The only thing better than crack was shooting speedballs. And I just love that so much. It was just like cocaine and heroin together was the best thing ever. And so when I got into spirituality, I was also interested in that. I was like, what's the like most hardcore spiritual practice? And going into silent retreat, not these fucking yoga retreats where you get to talk to people, and silent meditation for weeks, for months, for just felt like the heroin of the spiritual path. It's like the speedball of the spiritual path, you know, Vipassana retreats, you know, this Theravada and renunciation path just really, I think, is, you know, connected with my tendency to search for intensity and for, you know, what's the hardest path, not the easier ones, but the harder ones. That first decade, I was introduced to the mindfulness practices, which made sense to me. And then I was, of course, very early on introduced to the love, the heart practices, loving kindness and forgiveness and compassion, and I had so much resistance in the beginning to doing the heart practices. And I felt like, well, mindfulness works, it's practical, it's rational, but becoming loving and kind and compassionate doesn't even feel desirable, feels like unsafe, feels too vulnerable, feels too soft, too scary probably. But I took the direction and slowly over the years went from in the practices of saying the loving kindness phrase, like, may I be happy, may I be at ease, may I be free from suffering, and not meaning it at all. I'd say it because that was the meditation instruction, or saying to myself, I forgive you as much as I can in this moment, but not meaning it at all. And I feel like it was some years of a dry practice with the heart practices of like saying the words and not meaning them. But somewhere in that first decade of practice, probably with even in, within the first 5 years of doing it regularly and doing it on retreat and doing it daily, the internal relationship to kindness started to shift. And the internal relationship to forgiving myself started to shift. Around 10, maybe 10, 12 years into it, I came to a place where I'd been doing forgiveness daily, 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 really making it central, really started to see, like, I actually see how much of my suffering comes from resentment, from hating myself and hating other people. And I want to be free. That kind of something in me was just like, this is it. I want to get enlightened. I want to get free. I want to not suffer. And I started to see the practical utility of forgiveness and of learning to be in pain and not run from it and have compassion for it. Couldn't do it very well, but I saw it started to make sense. The puzzle started to come together. And about 12 years in, I don't know, somewhere between 10, 12 years in, I came to the first, I remember having a moment for the first time in my life where I didn't have any resentments, where I had actually forgiven myself and I could meet myself with kindness, compassion. I liked myself on some level and not the inflated ego trip of a self, but there's just a kind of a tenderness and a compassion for my own pain. About a decade, 12 years in, somewhere in there. I had a moment of forgiving some people in my life who had abused me and that I had been holding resentments towards when I was from childhood stuff. And I thought when I came to that moment of forgiveness, this is 20 something years ago, that I would be done forever. I forgot about impermanence. And I thought like, okay, I forgave them and then I'm done. Now I'm just going to live in this state of love and forgiveness. But I was, you know, totally wrong, because that's not how it works. That was just a moment of forgiveness. I had never had a moment of forgiveness before then. So of total forgiveness for myself and everyone else. Up to that time, if I brought, you know, certain things to mind, I met it with hatred. I came to a place a decade or so in where I could bring it all to mind and meet it with compassion, meet it with forgiveness, not hatred. And so the forgiveness practice continued from there. It was a momentary experience of liberation, not a permanent liberation. The second decade of practice, somewhere between, you know, 10 and 20 years, was, you know, at around 10 years, a little bit before 10 years in, my teacher said, we want you to teach. And since my father was a teacher, there was some nepotism there. My first book, Dharma Punks, came out, I guess it's 21, 22 years ago now. So I guess I was about 12, maybe 14 years into recovery and Dharma practice when I did Dharma punks, but I'd already been teaching. My teachers were already like, start some groups, try to pass this on to your generation. And that kind of, there was like a 15 years there of my practice that was really formed around, and this is continues to be true, but it feels like the formation of Against the Stream and the formation of Refuge Recovery and the Dharma punks kind of movement that all felt like so central to my practice, which was being of service, sharing the teachings with others, and helping the kind of community organization of like this alternative voice in Buddhism and how to kind of practice this and that angle that I've that made so much sense to me, which is that this is a path of rebellion. This is a path of going against the stream, that the idea that I had that meditation was like going with the flow and was, you know, counter to what the Buddha taught, which, you know, literally he said, this path, this middle path goes against greed, against hatred, against delusion. It's an act of rebelling, again, that greed, hatred, and delusion are the norm. That's easy to be angry. It's easy to be attached. It's really a radical act to let go. It's not just a kind of, you know, yoga, wine, let go party. It's internal rebellion against the very nature of us to create suffering for ourselves and to cling. I became a parent. I guess I was 20 years sober or so when I had my first child, and then another one 3 years later. Parenting feels like very central to my life and my practice and my, I don't know, kind of the way that I think about what I'm doing with my life. Definitely being of service and teaching, but being present for my kids in a way that I didn't get. Being engaged, being non-entangled, but very much connected, my children. You know, and the last 6 years have, I guess I'll end with this. I just have a couple more minutes, but I'll end with this. Of 6 years ago, a little over 6 years ago, when I was about 30 years into my path and I got canceled, most of you are probably aware of, like, I had this false accusation that didn't matter, but at least like everything went away, almost everything went away. And what an amazing practice that's been these last 6 years. I'm so grateful that I had the forgiveness practice and the compassion practice and I lost so many important relationships that I thought were important, relationships with some of my teachers that ended, with a lot of my, what I thought were kind of colleagues that ended. And it was really very painful, but because my practice, the Dharma, teaches me to meet pain with compassion. It was like the first 30 years of my recovery and my meditation practice felt like preparation for anything devastating that could happen. And it felt like, you know, beyond like the death of my children or something, sort of the most devastating thing that could happen, the biggest kind of betrayals happened in my life. I was on retreat in May. I said this recently, just to kind of end here. I was on a 10-day retreat with Ajahn Amaro, who's been my teacher for 33 years. And I had this experience in Thailand in May where there was a shift from forgiveness to gratitude, and gratitude for the pain, and gratitude for the betrayal, and gratitude for all of the difficulties these last few years in my life that allowed me to deepen the sense of compassion a little bit. And I certainly still, I'm not at the place of like, that was, I'm glad that happened. I'm glad, but I'm not in the place of like, I needed that. I feel like I did not need that. But since I got it, I'm really grateful that it got me a little bit more free, a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more of an open heart to my own pain and to the pain of others and the pain of this world. And so it's sort of where I'm landing. And Friday night, I did a sweat lodge ceremony with about 12 of my homies to celebrate my 36th anniversary. And the topic was gratitude. And it's sort of really where, you know, that genuine gratitude, not for the good stuff, but for the hard stuff. And if you're new to practice, if you're in a lot of pain, if you're, you know, just, you know, you can't fake that kind of gratitude. But when it happens and it's genuine and you can actually look at the pain in your life and be like, I've got this, the tools, the Dharma has provided me the tools to navigate all of this, no matter what happens, with mostly an open heart, with mostly compassion, with mostly equanimity and acceptance and forgiveness. So I'll leave it there for tonight. It's 8:30. Thank you. I will ask you if you care to, I'll encourage you, I'll invite you to consider a $36 donation to support Against the Stream in celebration of my 36 years on this path. So usually drop in, we ask for $20, $25, but if you want to be extra generous tonight and to give a $36 donation, maybe even consider doing a $36 recurring donation so that you just give that every month to support the nonprofit. The only way this thing, I've been teaching this Monday night class, I think it's 18 and a half, 19 years, every Monday here on the West Side in Los Angeles, by donation the whole time, with meditation centers the whole time. And we don't charge, we've never charged. It's always by donation and it's your voluntary contribution, but it's opportunities like this for me to encourage you to give a little bit more if you can. And know that if you're broke, you're welcome here regardless of ability to pay. And I believe that Jeff and Emily have posted that in the chat. There's a link to the donation page. Last piece announcement, there is a 10-day silent meditation. I talked a little bit about my experience on retreats. I'm teaching a 10-day silent retreat here in Los Angeles at the end of this month. I believe it starts on the 24th. It's 9 nights, 10 days, silent, sitting and walking, mindfulness, Vipassana retreat. There is space. We had some cancellations. There's space if people want to come. If you have the time and the energy and the financial ability to attend this retreat. It's on the website on againstthestream.com. Hope some of you make it to that. We've also had some openings. I'm taking people to India, to the footsteps of the Buddha pilgrimage, Bodh Gaya and Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, Bodh Gaya, where he was enlightened, Rajgir, and where he died. And anyways, we're going to kind of do this pilgrimage. And there's been some cancellations. There's some spots open for that too. If anybody wants to come with me and some of you to India in November, there's space in that. So I know Eric's coming and Judy's coming. And
Let's go.
We did a trip to Thailand last year that was really, really special. And this year we're doing India. Next year, I'm thinking maybe Sri Lanka, which is also a really cool Buddhist, Theravadan Buddhist country. And there's good surfing in Sri Lanka. So we could do a little surfing, a little pilgrimage. So I'll leave it there for tonight. Did I forget anything, Sebastian?
No, you got it.
I got it. Anybody that's on the East Coast, I am here next Monday. And then the following week, I'm going to be on the East Coast. I'm going to do a talk in Plymouth, Massachusetts on Wednesday the 11th. And then I'm going to be in New York City on Tuesday the 17th of September. So if you know people in New York City or in Massachusetts near Plymouth, I'm going to do some public talks out there. And then we have this 3-day retreat in Rhode Island at the Providence Zen Center. And those are, that retreat's through Refuge Recovery. So if you want information about that, look on the refugerecovery.org website. May any goodness that comes from our practice be shared with each other any merit that comes from my life's activities these last 36 years in recovery and on this middle path be offered outward in all directions for the benefit of all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible, and together may we create a positive change on this planet. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.